Welcome back to the programme now. Dr. Maureen Gaffney, psychologist and author, has joined me. And Maureen, arguably many people will spend a huge proportion of their life in their workplace, and that's what we're talking about today. First of all, you're very welcome indeed to the studio. Often we hear about getting the right work-life balance, which is a hard enough thing, negotiating with yourself, with your life, with your co-workers, with your managers and all that. But you say that the culture of work has changed.
Hugely. We always knew that people worked, you know, for mainly three reasons. You know, some people work just for a living and they get their fulfillment elsewhere. Some people work, as it were, they enter a career and their ambition is to climb the ladder until they get to the most senior position that they hope for. And then there was always a sort of a minority of people that were utterly devoted to their work. You know, they loved what they did. You know, they didn't count the hours, you know. And they were very happy people. You know, went with high levels of being engaged in your work. Now, that category, the last category, has ballooned in the sense that we have, but it's changed as well, in the sense that I think we've imported, you know, I've done a lot of work in the States, and when you're there, people's devotion to work has an almost religious quality. I mean, people work all hours. And they do so willingly, you know, in the sense that they talk a lot about their work, they identify with their work. In America, you know, people get 2 weeks holidays.
I know, it's very,
yeah, but
very,
you know,
little.
Marion, I recently met a honeymoon couple, it's happened before, and you know, in Europe, and they were there on their one and only honeymoon, and they weren't taking the full 2 weeks, because they felt that they just couldn't be away from work. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Was that pressure imposed on them by themselves, or was it imposed by them by a system?
It's a kind of a mixture now, Marion, in the sense that I think that's what globalization did, you know, is that it opened up competition to the whole world. And there was a sort of a greed as well, you know, that big change in the 80s, you know, where the idea of a business, you know, became just about making money for the shareholders. I mean, that has sort of dripped down into the lives of ordinary people. And so you have this hyper competition, and that sort of infected everything. You know, organizations are under huge pressure now. I mean, the single biggest complaint I would hear, no matter where I go into, is we're expected to do twice as much as we used with like half as many resources. And that was made worse then during the recession, you know, and there was cutbacks and so on. And people were left with, you know, much more to do. And of course, it hasn't really resolved itself yet.
No. There's another one threatened.
Yeah, exactly. And the you know, this is particularly high pressure for, you know, what are called knowledge workers. So, you know, in other words, people who have to use a lot of expertise, who have to deal with a huge amount of data, you know, like the high tech sector, the, you know, the bankers, finances, all of that kind of stuff. But you see it at every level. I'm always struck when I go into local supermarkets now. I never see the staff relaxing. And these are people who are not paid well. They're young. They're often doing it like, you know, to sort of make fees, college and so on. You know, and you see them there under this extraordinary pressure at the till. You know, you have these wretched machines, you know, the automatic checkouts, you know, going. And of course, they don't work half the time. And they're there checking out people at the counter, and often older people who don't want to use the machines. And then you have people coming over saying the thing isn't working. I don't know how they stand it.
It's the noise that would drive me berserk.
Exactly, yeah. So I think this, and then you have the big, big change that there's more women working now than ever before, including people who have children, but who want to keep their careers. And it's not just women, but there's been a big generational change in attitudes. Younger men want to spend more time with their families.
Which is terrific.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But all of that is combining to create what I think is an unprecedented crisis, really, about work-life balance, you know? And it's not just the hours people work, but very often in these hard-driving cultures, you have this... other thing, which is that you're expected to multitask, you know. There was one study a number of finance companies and, you know, like banks and so on and high-tech companies, but I think it applies to an awful lot of jobs. I would say it applies here in RTE, where, you know, researchers actually observed people's day-to-day work, and they found that people were interrupted on average every 3 minutes. Now, when we think about being interrupted, we know it's stressful, okay? We think, like, I've lost 5 minutes now because somebody has interrupted me that in a way they didn't have to. You're expected to answer emails immediately. At one time, Marion, you know, if someone got a letter, you know, they waited for 2 weeks for a reply. Then fax came in and, like, it was a sort of a couple of days. Now, like, it's like I emailed you 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, where are you?
Yeah, and you have, again, this sort of lazy culture in organisations, like, of everyone covering themselves by sending CC'd emails to everybody. So you're... this pinging going on the whole time.
That's right. And noise. There's a terrible lot of
it's
noise.
It's incredible. Yeah. And there's very interesting stuff, Marion, coming out now that really should make people rethink about this open plan office business. That was meant to be the hot new thing, you know, hot desking and, you know, sort of swapping ideas and this kind of hub of activity. That might suit people, you know, like young sort of startups, like who are 20, you know. But it, in fact, like, it is disastrous for people's concentration and the quality of their work.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a very interesting fact.
Will you not, please?
Oh, okay.
Will you not tell me a very interesting one? Because I want to give you time to tell it to me, and I have to take a break.
Okay, all right.
Thanks.
Interrupting me again?
Now, before I go back to Maureen, I want to read out a couple of things that came in vis-a-vis what she's saying to us. Apparently, we live in an economy now, Doctor, and no longer in a society. And another says, I have long thought Americans live to work while we work to live. Well, I don't know. We're getting there, aren't we?
Well, I think we are, Marion.
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly are.
You were going to tell me a story.
Yes. It's about, we're talking about distraction.
Yes.
You know, and that one study was showing that in particular companies that people were being interrupted on average every 3 minutes. Now, when you're interrupted by something, you know yourself that your concentration is disrupted and it takes a while to get back
to where you were. Yeah.
But most people think that's a matter maybe of a couple of minutes. There's actually data which is now telling us it takes 23 minutes and 15 seconds to get back to where you were. In other words, if you were there really concentrated on a particular piece of work,
yes,
right? And most people now have to concentrate.
Yes.
Then it takes, and someone interrupts you, the phone goes or you have to answer an email or someone comes up looking for something, it will take you 23 minutes and 15 seconds to get back.
Well, you wouldn't need to be interrupted too often, would you?
But you see, people are. And what's not recognised is that this isn't just a nuisance, but it's actually going against the entire idea of working so hard, which is that you do high-quality work. And even when you go back, your concentration... It takes a while to ramp up, you know, like, in other words, the quality of your thinking is affected. Now, the other thing is that these interruptions are kind of stressful. You know, your heart beats faster, your mood gets poorer. And that combines then, because it, as I'll be saying later, your mood actually is hugely important in work. So you take these forces, you know, that are bearing down on you in work, and of course distraction also when you go home because of, you know, you're under the same, a lot of people now, you know, carry their mobile phones. I mean, you're given a mobile phone by your work, and it's not because it's a perk, you know, it's because you're meant to be available. And often people are backing up things to do when, you know, in some, in some high level jobs,
yes,
you know, not even that high level jobs, but that if you work in a multinational, for example, you're working across different time zones and often you've virtual meetings, you know, conference calls,
yes,
at crazy hours. So you take the couple at home. If you take the average couple at home now, Marion, with kids, or even without kids, compared to their parents' generation,
yeah,
in their parents' generation, before they had kids, they would have had 35 hours a week to themselves. In other words, that would include eating the main meal together, hanging around together, chatting,
going for a
enjoying,
walk.
Yeah, enjoying each other's company. When they had kids, that reduced to 13 hours a week. Well, we all know that,
that dramatically.
Right? That dramatic, yeah. But here's what's happening now. People have nothing like that. They, before they have kids even, they only have 13 hours together a week. And when they have kids...
That's ridiculous.
That's what people have. Now, these are American data because we don't have that data here.
Right.
But anyone I've said that to says, that sounds about right. And then once they have kids, you know, particularly if both are working, they're left with 9 hours a week for themselves. 9 hours. Now, 9 hours, Marion, is less than an hour and a half a day. And in that hour and a half a day, you have to do, like, running a family, as you know, it's like running a small business, you know, with your kids, you know.
Yeah.
You have things to catch up with, you know, you have lunches to make, et cetera, et cetera. And most of the time, you know, for people with small kids in particular, by the time they get them settled in bed, and they come down, they're not even ready to talk. I mean, they're not able to talk. They just crash in front of the TV. And then, so is it any wonder that, you know, marriages are under strain?
Right.
You know, so
referring that to that caller that said, we're an economy rather than a society, somebody raised with me recently that in a previous generation, there was, broadly speaking, mother and father. Mother stayed at home,
yeah,
and looked after the house and the children. Father went to work. They could afford a house and they could afford a car.
They could.
And now you have two people working their legs off and they can't afford a house.
That's right.
And they're pressed with the car. Is that progress?
It's not, Marion. And I think we will look back on this era as a sort of, you know, a form of lunacy. Because, you know, I know this is hopelessly idealistic and it's not going to happen. But just imagine, you know, if big companies got together and said, you know what, like, you know, there's only one market out there. And, you know, if we all agreed, you know, like that... You know, we'll all reduce a bit. We'll still have to compete for that market. But it won't, but it's all been driven by this thing that happened in the 80s, you know, that the whole purpose of a company was to make a load of money for the shareholders. And we know where that's going. So I don't see it happening at that level. The only way I think it will happen is pressure from people themselves, you know. In other words, that there'll be a, because there is a kind of a crisis. An awful lot of people are not happy with the arrangements they have about their kids, for example. You know, they love their kids, they want their careers, but women are putting off having children, you know, longer and longer. There's more and more young women, you know, are having to go through the whole agony, you know, and risk of fertility treatment and so on. I mean, there's something has to give, I think, in all of that. Now, women aren't going to go back home, Marion. It's not going to give that way. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't any crystal ball about what's going to happen, but it does seem a very unsustainable model, you know.
Well, you say that we can't leave our troubles at the work door. And so this affects our mood, which in turn affects our work performance.
Yeah, because we're kind of in a time warp, Marion, you know, that we're still managing people at work you know, as if 'twas like the old days where people came in and they had a number of tasks to do and then they went home.
Moved them over there and there you go.
In the last 20 years, there's been at least a 50% increase in people working in teams. Most people now work in teams. Now, people used to work together before, but it was kind of a loose arrangement, you know. But the nature of work has changed, so it's not really possible to produce things now, the services we want, the products we want, without working very, very closely together in teams. Now, working together in teams, Marion, is difficult.
I rather like it,
But it requires a lot of, as it were, emotional intelligence to be able to kind of work together. We know Google did, and they have data on everything, and they did a really interesting, extraordinarily elaborate study a couple of years ago where they took all their own teams and they had data on everything, you know, and they knew the ones that, were very productive, came up with the best ideas, very creative, and those that were not so successful. And they did a gigantic study. And what they found was that, some things are obvious. If a team doesn't know what it's doing, there's no clear purpose and so on. If they feel that what they're doing is kind of useless, that you're a committee, really, that they're the kind of obvious things. But what they found that was most interesting was that one of the biggest differentiators between a team that's really, where people are really happy, very engaged with each other, they feel they're working at their best and come up with really innovative ideas, are teams with what was termed high levels of psychological safety. In other words, that whoever is running the team has created a culture where it's easy and acceptable to have difficult conversations. In other words, you can challenge things, you can bring up difficult issues, if someone isn't pulling their weight or you feel, anything that you say like that, the kind of stuff that you have to stuff down usually, yes. But that you create an atmosphere where people can do that without, as it were, being rejected or being punished.
And that's hard.
It's very hard to do, Marion. For example, in medicine, there's been a huge amount of studies in this. Because one of the most common problems, in hospitals is human error. Sometimes people spot things. They spot like that when a prescription is being handed over or notes are being handed over, that someone has been careless about something, and it's very hard to bring that up. Now when you create that kind of culture, then you get these things sorted out. They become a sort of a way of doing work, a kind of a constructive way of bringing something up.
Yeah.
Now that requires a bit of training, Marion, but it also crucially requires that people have built up a very high level of trust and liking between them. Like, for example, these teams that were really successful, if you observe them, people chatted, a good bit before the team started. You weren't sort of getting in totally oppressed by thinking of another 10 meetings to go to. They chatted. They said, how are things going? Is she over the flu? Or how's your mum? Or, whatever is going on. And then afterwards, they chatted again. So this is not a waste of time. This kind of bonding with people is actually hugely important.
What do you think then of managers, bosses, call them what you will, do they have the skills? I mean, would they look at you as if you had lost it if you were saying, how's your emotional intelligence?
Some do, yeah. I would say it's very patchy. I think in some of the multinationals, they put huge pressure on people. But my own experience of them is that they put an enormous investment in their in training. In other words, that people feel that no matter what they come in as, that they're going to get a lot of opportunities to keep developing and growing.
And to do stuff they like.
That's even to kind of change, you know, to swap and so on. And that's one of the biggest issues that comes up in feedback, you know, when you know, because, you know, all these feedback forms, you know, is one of the things that consistently is low in most organisations is the feeling that you're getting no chance to develop. And people really, really want to feel that they're going to grow and develop. It's not a kind of, you know, a sort of a perk. It's fundamentally part of the enjoyment of a job. And a lot of managers interpret that as giving people a chance for promotion. Now, obviously, you know, there's not that many promotions around and you have to find other ways, you know.
So I
think that people are not looking at the science, you know. There's still, I think, a very strong feeling in organisations that really, you know, they pay lip service to, you know, Great Place to Work, you know, kind of, you know, giving out Employee of the Month and, you know, nothing wrong with that, like, but there's no sense that it actually really, really counts, that you can't leave your mood at the door. There was a really interesting study done of multiple organisations, so, you know, a huge number of different workplaces, and people had to keep very detailed diaries, and they made it easy for them at the end of the day. And they were asked a simple question. They were asked, what's the event of the day that most stands out for you? Now, we know from other science that the thing that stands out for you at the end of the day is something that aroused the most emotion, either positive or negative. That's actually what stands out for most of us. And what they found was that the things that stood out for people, you could, as it were, put them into two categories, uppers and downers. So the uppers were anything that gave you a little bit of a lift during the day. Yeah. Someone saying thank you, someone being appreciative, and particularly someone doing something to help you make progress in your work. Someone actually doing something that helps you do what you want to do.
Right.
Because a great day at work, Marion, is going to work in the morning with a list of things to do and coming out in the evening and thinking, I did it, you know?
Yeah.
I wonder how many people out there, you know, have that experience at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But then the downers were things like being micromanaged, someone like breathing down your neck about something, feeling that you're not being trusted, not being appreciated. I mean, there's a famine of appreciation at work. You know, it takes so little time to actually thank someone properly, and yet people don't. You know, they're careless about it. And
are careless about their well-being.
Very. They are. Yeah. They are.
You were saying about the uppers and downers.
Yeah, so when you count all these uppers and downers and you can then, you know, see the effects that they have, you know, because they have other measures then on how productive the team was and whether people could come up with good ideas and so on. And what they found was that the more uppers you had, now these are not big things, Marion, these are the small interactions that you have. But people who are good managers are sort of consciously aware of that. You know, they're not so wrapped up, you know, in what they're doing. They have a kind of a strategy that, you know, my job is to make other people's jobs easier. That's their conscious strategy. And what they found was that the more uppers there were in a day, the more progress people made in their work. That, you know, was evident in their productivity. You have a 50% increase in your chance of coming up with a good idea on a day when you have more uppers than downers. Now, Marion, good ideas are very scarce on the ground. Yeah. And if I ask any organisation what's the biggest issue you face, they say innovation. We have to innovate. We have to find new ways of doing things, you know, to keep competitive. And coming up with a good idea, Marion, that kind of gratefulness is absolutely... Well, there you have. Now, if I said here today to you, Marion, that I have this little technique or technology that will, you know, guarantee that people will have a 50% increase in coming up with a good idea, Marion, I'd be in great demand, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But yet, here it is at our fingertips. But the other thing, which is even more interesting, is that positive and negative are not equal opportunity feelings. In other words, one negative in the day, even if it's a small thing, has five times the effect on your functioning and on your productivity and on your creativity, then five positives. Now, that doesn't mean that positives aren't important.
Yeah.
It just means that you have to have an awful lot of them to absorb the effect.
Negatives.
You know, because at the end of a day, we all have had the experience, you know, you're so busy, you know, something happens that bothers you, that annoys you, you know, or worries you, and you put it out of your mind because you have so much to do. You go home and you're even busier when you go home, and then you go into bed absolutely exhausted. The very minute your head hits the pillow, what's going to come into your head? You start thinking about it and you start ruminating about it. And, you know,
and so,
and then you go in tired in the morning in an even worse mood. And, you know, so the impact, we use up an enormous amount of cognitive energy and emotional energy processing anything negative. So the idea that you can come in and throw your weight around, you know, or just be obnoxious to people and that, you know, they'll get over
do
it.
This,
and
do
there
that.
Is there is a kind of a machismo still, I think, and I include women in this, you know, who sort of had to work extraordinarily hard and put huge pressure on themselves and sacrifice a lot in terms of seeing their kids or maybe having no kids at all. And when they get to a certain position, you know, often the attitude is like, well, if I did it, you can do it, you know.
Right. Couple of calls in for you. Marion, many moons ago, my first woman boss senior manager was hugely in favour of work-family balance. She left every day at 4:30 p.m. while we foolish men worked until 9 p.m. most days to the annoyance of our wives and partners. Bosses, male or female, put themselves first, always. Another one said, recently had an interview with an American company in Dublin. They were proud to say, I hadn't read this before I read it, if you know what I mean. They were proud to say it was a 24/7 job. And of course, they all looked miserable.
Yeah, but you see, Marion, if you think about it, 50 years ago, you know, if you had a high status job, like say, for example, work the bank manager or something like that, the signal of your status was that you had more leisure time, that you had more free time. You remember bankers' hours, Marion? Do you remember them? You know, starting at 10 and closing at 4 and they went home at 4. Now, you signal your status by saying how busy you are. It's how many hours you work now. And I would include bosses in that, actually.
Right. I work in the tech sector. The work is an online support service. For the last year, the company I'm now with only operate a working from home model. No more commuting, no more working with 100 other people in the same space, no more traffic jams, no more every 3 minute interruptions, no need for a car. Great, says Liam in Galway. And can I say, and so say all of us. And that, of course, could bring us into a row about broadband, but we won't go there today. This pressure is not just in private companies. That's a very short one. I spent 35 years in consulting engineering. Starting out, the design and drawing office was an oasis of relative calm, punctuated by the odd phone call or quiet conversation. Now they're noisy, too much talking, constant messaging, beeping of phones, laptops, Skype calls, and on and on and on. You left out Facebook and WhatsApp and various other things like that. Why do people talk about Teams all the time in work context now? It's all just jargon, and empire building people are individuals. I'm going to have to just cut them off. I could go on and on. Maureen Gaffney is speaking a lot of sense. I'm a firm believer in job sharing to relieve stress. Less childcare, travel costs, more quality time with family, a win-win situation. And then the same point, what about working families? I work with three members of the one family. It's very tricky. And everything is taken back to their family kitchen, which I can well imagine.
Yeah. Oh, no, that is very tricky.
Yeah. Okay, Maureen, as always, Maureen Gaffney, psychologist and author. Thank you very much indeed. And we can all go off and feel grumpy now about
it. We're all too busy, Marion.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. We'll take a break.